Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm Jim Dandy.
I am happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, Olivia Wilde, the director of the modest indie hit Booksmart and the upcoming Don't Worry Darling, has had a pretty tough couple of weeks. We tend to eschew tabloid gossip on this show because that's not really our bag. You know, that's not what we do. But there's a lot of it swirling around this movie, and it's having a genuine, or at least potentially genuine, who knows, we'll see what happens, impact on the business of the movie. So give me a second while I walk you through all this. All right, so Wilde's follow-up to Booksmart was hugely desired by the studios. 18 bidders all trying to get Olivia Wilde to direct this movie for them. There was a bidding war. Theatrical guarantees were proffered, et cetera, et cetera. But almost from the beginning, there's been trouble in paradise. First, the film lost its leading man, Shia LaBeouf, under mysterious circumstances. Scheduling issues were cited, though at the time he was caught up in accusations of abuse of his girlfriend. We all remember that, right? And then Shia's replacement, Harry Styles, embarked on an on-set affair with Wilde that led to the dissolution of her relationship with the much-beloved Jason Sudeikis, who was riding a goodwill high thanks to Ted Lasso. Wilde was served with custody papers while on stage at CinemaCon, leading to embarrassment and headlines, etc., etc. Here's the most gossipy part of all. Apparently, star Florence Pugh has decided that she is not doing press for this movie outside of whatever she's doing at Venice, where it's debuting, in large part because of her annoyance with the way that Wilde and Styles carried on set. As Matthew Bellany noted in his newsletter, trying to film something as ambitious as this movie, which is something like a Stepford Wives-influenced sci-fi, thriller, mystery, drama, I don't know, trailer's very interesting, which I'm sure is leading to some concern with the studio. Trying to shoot something as ambitious as this during COVID-19 with all the precautions therein is hard enough, but to do it with the director and leading man simply disappearing for large stretches of time made it nearly impossible for the star, Florence Pugh. For her part, Pugh is staying silent, aside from complaining about the early trailer that highlighted her character's sexual side. And the silence is conspicuous in the sense that she is thanking lots of people, co-stars, the key grip, the guy who gets her drinks on set, but not her director. On top of all that, this week, Wilde decided to throw LaBeouf under the bus and said he was fired from the movie because his process was destructive or something like that. And LaBeouf responded by sending an email that insisted Wilde knows this is a lie and then seems to have leaked a video. I assume it came from him. I can't imagine who else it would have come from. Leaked a video that Wilde had sent him begging him to stay on the production, which he says he left because there wasn't time to rehearse. And in this video, Wilde trashes one, quote, Miss Flo, end quote, perhaps hinting at why Pugh has no interest in sitting down for interviews about this film. In other words, lots of drama here. There's affairs and there's catfights and all sorts of stuff, you know, all sorts of stuff going on. But as Bellany reported in his newsletter, The Quorum's David Heron found awareness on this film has increased 24% over the past week. And of those who are now interested in seeing it, 70% said that they were newly interested because of all the drama. I'll just add to all this my own personal poll of one. My wife is A, more aware of the movie, and B, more interested in going to see it precisely because she feels the need to keep up what's going on in this world of kind of gossipy blogging. Alyssa, is this proof of the old saying that all news is good news?
Man, I will be curious to see what happens with this. I mean, I think it's fascinating in part because Wilde is clearly running what I think is now an established playbook of sort of presenting herself as, you know, a woman making, you know, tough decisions in a business that's not necessarily friendly to that, and at a time when she is, you know, being treated badly by her former partner, right? I mean, she's running the, like, and I should say all of this may be true, right? Like, we don't know. Jason Sudeikis has said that he did not ask for her to be served at CinemaCon and, like, in the middle of a professional event. May or may not be true. I can't imagine that, like, he was particularly involved in the logistics of service to her, since that's something that would be handled by a lawyer he hired who then hires a process server. But hey, maybe he decided he wanted to upstage her. Maybe, you know, the dynamic with LaBeouf is more complicated than that video appears, and she really did want to get rid of him because it's bad energy. But clearly, like, I think the playbook where, you know, you sell yourself as a director in part by pointing out sort of all of the obstacles that you had to go through to get a project made or to be making a project in the first place. Like, that's established as a thing that gets headlines. Whether it gets sympathy is another question, but I think there's probably a demographic of moviegoers who are like, I want to support this female director even more because I think she has been wronged on some level. And I can sort of see why someone might go for that. Although Wilde seemed to kind of have been in a position where she didn't necessarily have to, right? I mean, like you said, there was a bidding war for this project. You know, I think she's had a lot of support from her studio. The narrative around her was already pretty good. And so I think there was like another version of this where she could have played things like the, you know, getting paper served on her, could have played that cool and, you know, kind of emerged from it with a different vibe, right? I mean, you know, Kathryn Bigelow, you know, I think has made a bunch of, you know, interesting, well-regarded movies. She was in a relationship with Mark Boll, her much younger screenwriter, and I believe they got together while working on either The Hurt Locker or Zero Dark Thirty. And that is just not the narrative script that she plays at all, ever, right? I mean, and Bigelow is a very different filmmaker. She is interested in masculinity as a subject material in a way that, you know, Wilde is much more interested in femininity as subject material. You know, she did not come up as, you know, an unusually good-looking actress who was famous, like, even more for her looks than for her acting ability. And so it's possible that Wilde feels a need to reinvent herself more dramatically. And so I can both see why she might take this route, but boy, does it seem like there are a lot of vulnerabilities in this particular path for her.
Well, yeah, I mean, the thing that jumps out at me about the whole story this week, particularly about the LaBeouf stuff, is she seems to be very explicitly trying to capture that sort of progressively minded, you know, look at me girl bossing this and getting rid of the abuser and saying, we don't want you. And it's just a total cell phone. She walked into a trap of her own making, which I find interesting. But like the other element of this that is intriguing to me is, again, I even if it's not a conscious strategy, it seems to be working in terms of getting people more interested in the movie, or at least more aware of it. Right, Peter?
Well, to some extent. I mean, the piece you mentioned earlier, the Puck News piece, suggests that awareness of the movie, which wasn't high to begin with, started around 17%. And since all of the headlines have been made over the past week or so, has risen to, I think, 21%. So that's a big increase in sort of percentage terms, but it's from a pretty low baseline, right? It's still not a movie that has a huge amount of awareness about it. And so maybe this will end up drawing some people to theaters, and maybe it will end up working in favor of the film. But man, if so, that's a pretty sad commentary on the nature of the film business, advertising, like whatever. I didn't know anything about any of this until you guys emailed it to me in our, you know, weekly discussion over the weekend.
You're so far above it all. You're looking
down
at... I was
so much better off until, like, having not read any coverage of this. Because ultimately, like, I care about the movie. I'm interested in this film. I want to go see if it's any good. The only detail out of any of this that seemed, like, of some relevance to my interest was the allegation, which was made via anonymous sources, right? But that Olivia Wilde was not sufficiently present on set. And again, this has been laundered through a bunch of sourcing. Doesn't seem like it, you know, so we don't know exactly how true that is, whether it was one incident or three, or whether it was every day she was gone for 6 hours, right? Like when she should have been there for setups, that sort of thing. But like, I'm interested in stories of production and how production works. But like, what? Who these people are sleeping with or not, and like whether they get divorced? They're celebrities. They do stuff. They have lives. Who cares? It's totally irrelevant to the thing that is interesting or not, which is the movie itself.
Well, it certainly if some of the early discussion of Harry Styles' performance in this movie is to be believed, it has some impact there. Supposedly, not the greatest We'll see. Again, we'll see. It's hard to judge all of that.
This is the other problem with all of this. No one has seen this movie yet. This is not shown for festival audiences. This is not shown for critics.
Debuts at Venice.
To the extent that this is going to be productive for a film like this, and as an advertising play, as a kind of marketing, it's that this stuff front runs the actual film. And again, I just feel like that is an unfortunate set of circumstances for good cinema, because. Like, in some ways, I'm worried that it will work, that like this set of headlines will end up driving people to the movie, regardless of the quality of the film, regardless of the reviews, regardless of what's in it, whether Olivia Wilde did a bang up job as a director during a trying circumstance, or whether this is sort of a misfire that has, you know, that has some progressive ideology to it that people were hoping that they could sell the movie based on that. Like, I have no idea. The only thing I know about the actual quality of this film at all is Olivia Wilde directed one movie that got good reviews, and the script for this movie was on the blacklist, which is not necessarily always a sign that a movie is going to be good. However, it is a sign that a bunch of interested parties who often have good taste thought that the script was good.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing I would say is that as a person who both enjoys juicy celebrity gossip and fine cinema, I think this is actually the rare place where there is, you know, people find stories about on-set chemistry interesting, right? And this is being marketed in part as a movie that's like, you get to see Harry Styles have some pretty explicit sex with people.
I barely know what a Harry Styles is. Like, I'm aware of
Christopher Nolan's Dunkirk.
Right. So I'm aware that Harry Styles was in Dunkirk, and like, he sings and he's got good hair.
Yeah. And like, he is an artist who went independent from a popular boy band. He's like a huge sort of like teen sex icon in part. And part of what's interesting about him is that he, you know, plays with ambiguous gender presentation in ways that signal.
So he's Gen Z Justin Timberlake?
Much, much more so on the like ambiguous gender presentation, like wears dresses on the red carpet and stuff. And so, you know, like buzz about him and Olivia Wilde essentially like sneaking off to like bang it at every spare moment on the set, like, is synchronistic with the movie's marketing in some extent, right? Like, if the selling point to this movie is like Harry Styles is just a fantastic lay, like stories about that like being real are working together with the advertising for the movie. At the same time, like, if, you know, he and Florence Pugh hated each other, or she thought he was totally non-professional in part because he was off, you know, banging their director, that's going to be something that people sort of look at the movie to be like, oh, does that show up on screen? And so, you know, I, to a certain extent, like, maybe it's bad that this is coming out before the movie. Maybe it's a huge cell phone by Wilde. I think the idea that it has nothing to do with the movie itself is maybe a somewhat narrow reading of, you know, the way this movie, like, this is a movie where, like, ideally Olivia Wilde wants, like, teenage girls to be, like, sneaking into it, right? That's sort of the shtick. And so I think the parts of it, of this story that are about Wilde sort of selling herself as, like, a feminist cinematic hero are indicative of a moment, but not necessarily that interesting. But in a weird way, like, the allegations of just, like, mess and drama are maybe more relevant to the actual marketing play for the movie. And I think that's interesting.
I maybe not fully retract my statement that none of this is relevant to the film, but I will only be interested in it after the fact. And so to me, like, it's not that I want to go into movies necessarily not knowing anything. I watch trailers, I read, you know, festival coverage, that sort of thing. And sometimes if there's like on-set production issues that are of particular interest, like, it's not like I don't read the coverage of that sort of thing. At the same time, this seems like a lot of very personal drama that happens to have some sort of echo to what the theme of the film may be, right? And not having any idea at all just makes it sort of seem like divorce is bad. It seems like it sucks. it seems unpleasant. I don't know. Like, people have relationships and they're complicated. What are we supposed to do with this if you care about movies? Right now, without having seen the film, without even being able to refer to somebody else's review of the film.
But this is like classic old school Hollywood drama, man. I find it interesting that you are couching this solely in terms of the artistry of the film, which fine, like that is the thing I most care about as well. But like the idea that gossip hasn't been a thing that puts butts in seats since literally the beginning of the film industry is very, very, it's amusing. I find it amusing.
Like what people do is they look up the reviews on Rotten Tomatoes, they click top critics.
Back in 1927, they were like, give me that Rotten Tomatoes score, Mabel. I need to see, is it fresh or is it a splat?
And in the old days, what they'd do is they'd buy the New York Sun and the New York Times, and they'd compare their two favorite critics, and they'd like, right? And they'd sort of average out the roof. That's, I assume that's how people made choices about movies.
Siskel and Ebert in the 1930s. That's what it all was.
Now they just listen to us, right?
Side note on all of this, the person who comes out looking best in this whole situation is Florence Pugh.
Undisputedly.
The person who comes out looking second best in all this is Chris Pine, who's nowhere to be seen. He's like, Chris Pine is just looking down on all this drama from Mount Olympus saying, no.
Off being handsome, wearing tropical shirts, like maybe playing some bongo drums. Like,
I did really appreciate learning that Florence Pugh was like, I'm sorry, I have to shoot Dune 2. Great. Like, good. And Oppenheimer. It's like, okay, you're going to be in my two favorite movies next year. Like, and instead of joining in this mess, I like you more now because you're like focused on the work.
Yeah, it's very interesting that she has gotten along very well with, like, notoriously, you know, kind of like film Twitter skeptical guys like Denis Villeneuve and Christopher Nolan and Olivia Wilde. She's just like, I want nothing to do with just washing my hands of all this. All right. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or an controversy that stereotypically gendered gossip around a lady director's sexual adventures is leading to a massive increase in interest in the movie that we're talking about? Alyssa.
It's controversial.
Peter.
I think... that's how I feel about all of this. I don't care.
It's non-traversial that this controversy is sparking interest. I'll put it that way. Put it that way. All right, make sure to tune in for our bonus episode this Friday, in which we discuss the ever-widening gap between critics and audiences when it comes to blockbuster entertainment. And now on to the main event, Samaritan. You don't know what Samaritan is? Weird. It's right there on Prime Video. You probably have access to it right now, and yet you don't even know about it. How very odd. Yes, Samaritan is one of those titles that was picked up by Amazon during the purchase of MGM, and rather than shell out low to mid eight figures to get it ready for theaters with a proper ad campaign and beef up the special effects, etc., Amazon just decided to throw this Sly Stallone action flick up on the streaming service. And spoiler talk is going to commence here, so if you're worried about spoilers for Samaritan, the movie that you've been looking forward to for months and years now as the release date kept getting pushed back, turn off your app, turn it out, to unplug your headphones. We're going to talk some spoilers here. All right, so Samaritan is a comic book movie without the comic book to base it on.
That's not true.
Oh, is this based on a comic book?
Well, sort of, and we should actually talk about that. There is a comic book that that provided some source material for this.
But it was a spec script, I thought.
This is actually the interesting thing, is this was a spec script first in around 2010 or so, then got turned into a comic book in 2013 or 2014,
Then
only afterwards did it get re-turned into a movie during the sort of the peak of the comic book boom. This script got sort of put into production in 2019 or so, not put into production, but greenlit to actually move forward in 2019 or so, at the point at which every studio was like, I guess people will go see anything that has superheroes in it?
Yeah. All right. So we'll discuss that more in a second. In the opening montage, we learn of Samaritan and his brother Nemesis, siblings whose superpowers made them both beloved and feared. After the boy's parents were killed by an angry mob, Samaritan decided to help those who needed it, while Nemesis turned to evil to punish the society that killed his folks. The two brothers battled one another until they died in a fire explosion at a power plant. Or did they? Teenager Sam Cleary, who's played by Javon Walton, believes that the guy who lives across the street from him, Joe Smith, played by Sly Stallone, is in fact Samaritan. And as anyone who has seen the trailer knows, Smith does in fact have superpowers. Can he rescue the city from the malaise and despair that is quietly sucking out its soul? Can Joe stop local gang leader Cyrus, who's played by Pilou Asbeck, I can never get that guy's name right, but he's a good actor, I like him, from plunging the city into darkness and leading riots as he dons the mantle of Nemesis? More importantly, can anyone explain to me the big twist near the end of this movie? Okay, shocker, Joe isn't Samaritan, he was Nemesis, and after killing his brother, he decided to stop being Nemesis for reasons? For reasons? Sacrifice something? He wants to honor his brother who he hated so much he had him killed? I don't know, it's unclear.
He got old and his back was covered in weird scars.
But that doesn't have anything to do with it. The whole thing is very messily plotted to the extent that it undermines the very basic theme, right? Which is that people need hope in the form of exemplars to better themselves and their surroundings, blah, blah, blah. But like the plot is so ridiculously underbaked that we don't really get to it. Weirdly, the movie that Samaritan most called to mind for me was The Dark Knight Rises, but way, way dumber than The Dark Knight Rises. If Den of Thieves, remember the movie Den of Thieves? That movie's basically Idiot Heat. Then Samaritan is basically Idiot Dark Knight Rises. And for starters, let's look at the character of Cyrus, who is basically Moron Bane. To the extent that he's like wandering around the streets of his city in a shearling jacket and a mask, and he's telling people that they need to riot and take back their city to punish the overclass that has oppressed them.
And he's even like, for the people, for the people. He like gives the same monologue, except
he gives the same monologue. And then later in the movie, he gives somebody a chance to run away, and then he shoots them in the back. And he says that you always want them to have hope before you break them. I'm just like, this is literally, you're just Moron Bane. This is Moron Bane. All right. So anyway, you know, sometimes I worry, as a reactionary, that I'm so desperate for like the modest hints of conservatism that I can find in art that I'll lap up just about anything. But Samaritan puts those fears to rest, because this is an almost aggressively reactionary movie, right? The villain is talking about the importance of punching up. Nemesis always punched up against, you know, people who were bad, and the cops are terrible and riots are good, actually. They can restore justice to the city by, you know, taking down the bad folks. And, you know, in theory, like, okay, I like people like this to be shown as evil. That could be good, right? But no, this movie's not good. It's not good at all. One last final note here. Just the federal government needs to immediately pass a law banning films from using fire in their climactic set pieces, or burning buildings or anything like that, if they're not actually going to set any fires. CGI fire should be considered a crime against humanity, punishable by incarceration in The Hague. Peter, you seem to like this movie more than I did. What have I gotten wrong here?
Well, it's not a good movie, but it is a kind of representative one in a lot of ways. And a lot of that starts with the backstory, which we were talking about earlier. This movie started as a spec script and couldn't be sold as a spec script. So what happened was the story idea was then turned into a comic book by a little known comic book publisher, Mythos Comics, I believe it is, in 2013, 2014, around then. And then nothing happened. But in 2019, it was a script again, and people were like, we need to make absolutely anything that has, like, we will make and fund anything with a superhero concept, especially if it sort of purports to be a kind of deconstruction of the superhero concept, because, you know, people like get the rules of the superhero movie at this point. And they signed up Sylvester Stallone, and they like set this for production starting at the end of February 2020.
What happened in February of 2020?
Well, not February, but one or two weeks after this movie kind of sort of started production, it shut down for reasons that we all remember. It was a bad time. They weren't making movies for a while. So it did start back up again before vaccines came out. You know, with COVID protocols, they actually managed to get people back to work. Went back into production in October of 2020, and we're only just now seeing this thing, right? And so this is, one of the reasons we're seeing it only on streaming via Amazon, and it was also wrapped up in the crazy MGM deal that Amazon did, you know, over the last couple of years. And so this movie is just really interestingly representative of like the last 10 or 12 years of kind of mid to big budget studio trends and all of the weirdness that has affected, you know, distribution issues and streaming and all of that, right? And it's, It's like if you wanted to kind of understand a bunch of the stuff that has happened in Hollywood, not if you wanted to watch a good movie, but if you wanted to understand a bunch of things that Hollywood has gone through and the weird business and creative revolutions that we have seen over the past decade or so, you could pick a lot worse movie to look at than Samaritan, because it seems to kind of, it's like Forrest Gump in its way, right? It's just sort of always in the middle of like whatever the heck is going on and whatever weirdness is happening, from the sort of the post Endgame superhero boom through the pandemic, right? And then into the weird business deals and the, you know, streaming only release. As a movie, I guess I didn't think, like I said, I didn't think it was good, but I also thought it could have been a lot worse. It's relatively cleanly shot. It, like Sylvester Stallone, there's some bits of this that are kind of appealing just because Sylvester Stallone is kind of pleasant to watch on screen, even if he is old and slow and lumbering. And the movie actually does try to do something, I think, a little bit different with the superhero formula, even if it mostly ends up replicating a bunch of stuff from Dark Knight Rises in a kind of lesser and secondary way. And so I thought I was really going to hate this and it was going to be a complete piece of trash. And instead I thought, well, that wasn't a good movie. But it, like, I could almost see something that was worthwhile in it. And I also think, I also sort of, like, as I was, like, re-editing it and sort of, like, offering, you know, thinking about, like, well, what would I have done with this? I was thinking that there's, like, a version of this movie that's R-rated, that's, you know, more violent, that has less CGI fire, and that actually feels a little more like an 80s throwback, that has more kind of, you know, catchphrases and Sylvester Stallone doling out justice in a bloody way and all that. I don't know. I just didn't hate it. And I thought the story of it was sort of interesting. And like, this is what we end up with in this weird sort of kind of dark period for theaters, when a lot of stuff isn't coming out, when, you know, as we've talked about, when it's all sort of, when we're staring at this like weird release schedule in August and September, when I was, again, not in love with this movie, and I wouldn't even say it was good, but I felt like, oh, this was, it outperformed expectations in a bunch of ways, and there was an interesting backstory.
Alyssa, did it outperform your expectations?
I would say it about met my expectations, but my expectations were fairly low. And in a weird way, this movie got me thinking about what it must be like to be an actor who is never going to be particularly successful in the U.S., but is going to keep working steadily, in part because they fit sort of a need that the entertainment industry has. And Pilo Asbeck kind of fits that description for me. Like, he's very good at playing, like, thinly written maniacal bad guys, right? Like, that's his deal in this movie. That was his deal on Game of Thrones, where he played Euron Greyjoy. He does good crazy eye and, like, sort of charismatic monologue. And I don't think he's ever going to do that much more than that in Hollywood movies. I could be wrong. Maybe he has, like, an incredibly sensitive, you know, Shakespearean actor hiding in him somewhere. Maybe he is, like, all he's ever wanted to be in his life is, like, the next coming of black and white slapstick comedy. But I kind of think that's basically what he's going to do forever. In the same way, Dasha Polanco, who kind of broke out as an inmate who gets pregnant by a prison guard on Orange is the New Black, we saw her last summer in The Heights, is always, like, when people need, like, a, you know, pretty but not knockout, like, sort of mother, you know, like, young maternal Latina figure, like, she's going to get cast and stuff. Is she going to get to do other things? Like, I mean, she's the one of the salon ladies in The Heights who gets, like, nothing to do. You know, Stephanie Beatriz has more lines than she does, et cetera. And so, you know, she will probably continue to work, but is always going to be, like, the fifth or sixth build person, even in a small project like that. And it's interesting, you know, we were just talking about, you know, sort of celebrity gossip and, you know, sort of buzz early in the movie. It's like, we don't talk very much about people who just kind of fill those roles and fill them, like, competently and well. But the entertainment industry has a huge need for those people. And there are more people who want to be actors than there are acting roles, period. But being able to sort of fill an archetype, I think, is kind of an underrated skill, in part because many of the people who could fill archetypes are going to be upset about not being able to be stars and sort of drop out of the business. And so this movie left me with just like a little bit of sympathy for people who are kind of in that position. And then also I would say I just like old, slightly broken down Sylvester Stallone. Like, he's good at that in Creed. He's good at that in this. Like, he, you know, he has just like a nice rueful streak at this stage in his career. And, you know, we've talked a little bit on this podcast about the number of Hollywood actors who are getting just like huge and jacked, right? And, you know, maybe some of those guys will decide to become less jacked over time because it's exhausting. But in a weird way, Sylvester Stallone is sort of like a flash forward into their physical futures, right? And, you know, his performances, like, he doesn't do a lot of, Sylvester Stallone, again, is like, he's not going to go off and like star in a Joel Cohen movie, right? Like, that is not his future.
I'd watch that, though.
I mean, as would we all. But, you know, Joel Cohen, call my agent. But he is this reminder that, like, you can bring something, like, soulful and a little rueful, even to a very dumb, like, not very good-looking movie. And, you know, that's a standard that more people should aspire to.
Yeah, I do love Sylvester Stallone in most things, and he's fine in this. I'm one of the few people who defended Last Blood, which I thought was a more interesting movie than critics and audiences, frankly, tended to give it credit. But he's very good in that, and he's been playing this kind of like broken down figure who is trying to be a symbol for something else for like 15 years now. Like, when did the Rambo Goes to Thailand movie, or where Rambo Goes to Indonesia? I can't even remember where that movie was set. Movie come out, but that was like 2007, 2008, something like that. So he's been doing this for a while now.
Underrated movie.
It's a good. I think it's properly rated. I think most people really like that one. It's the one on the border that they didn't like. You know, nobody wants to watch him fight drug cartels, apparently.
It is interesting to look back at his 80s body, though, and think about what he looks like now and how has clearly affected his physical presence. I was watching Rambo Part 2 for. I don't know why.
Rambo First Blood Part 2?
First Blood Part 2, and there's a torture scene in which he's shirtless. And, like, they're just these incredible close-ups of his back muscles that are, like, that's a special effect. Yeah. Except you did it with your body, man! And I don't know, it's awesome. It's kind of awesome.
Well, the difference between First Blood and First Blood Part 2 is very noticeable. I mean, he went from being like big dude, you know, well built, to being like, I am built like a house. You could put things on my shoulders and I could carry them for miles. Sort of guy.
I mean, that's the future for all of these, superhero actors who have bulked up. Maybe not exactly the future, but this is like. They're going to end up on the, you know, he has talked about, I'm not saying anything he hasn't said on public record, but he has been actually a pretty vocal proponent of older men with, you know, who lifted weights using human growth hormones, which is sort of like steroids, but not exactly, right? But it's a muscle bulking thing that you take for your body. And, he takes stuff to keep his body big, and right, and it's like it changes his performance, and it changes the way he walks and moves, right? Not just the sort of the size of him and the presence, but it adds something that's really kind of interesting to see on screen that we're only sort of just now in the past decade or so getting to see, like, what those guys who looked like superheroes when they were 35 or 40, what they end up looking like when they're 70.
Well, and Stallone is interesting in this regard because, you know, among other things, like, Arnold Schwarzenegger doesn't act anymore. So you see him as like a big dude, but you don't see him doing, you know, ostensibly ambitious things with his body and necessarily using his body as a performance aid in quite the same way. And so Stallone is really sort of the vanguard in that regard. And it's interesting to watch.
Yeah. You guys excited for Samaritan 2? I assume we're all going to be on Prime Video.
You
day
mean
one.
Nemesis? It's going to have to be called Nemesis because Samaritan doesn't exist.
Samaritan 2, The Return of Nemesis.
Yeah.
Cyrus's brother decides to take revenge against Nemesis, and he is called Samaritan. All right, so what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on this movie? Alyssa.
I mean, in what universe are you contemplating watching this movie? Are you contemplating watching this movie while you, like, drink a beer and check your email? Then, like, thumbs up, fine. If you're looking for, like, a groundbreaking, you know, reinterpretation of the superhero drama, then thumbs down.
Peter.
12-year-old me gives this a thumbs up, though it could have been better. But unfortunately, today, years old me has to give it a thumbs down with the caveat that it was much better than I thought it would be.
You know, Alyssa raises a good point. I thought about talking about this earlier and didn't, but I will mention it now. So I watched this movie half on my phone at the gym and then half at home on my TV because I wanted to treat it like a piece of content, like not like an actual movie that you actually, you know, think about, but just like, oh, I need something to do. And that's what these things are here for. And I do think that I think it probably downgraded my overall viewing enjoyment, but also like that's how you were supposed to watch these things. And I find it vaguely frustrating and sad that is the extent to which we are expected to treat them. Again, I was watching it like I assume most people will, which is as a
in portrait mode
adventure in content. And even then, it's still a thumbs down because, like I said, it's idiot Dark Knight Rises. Sadly.
With the subtitles on.
I did not have the subtitles on. I should have. I should have really gotten the whole effect. All right, that's it for this week's show. Make sure to swing by atma.thebulwark.com for our bonus episode on Friday. Make sure to tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SonnyBunch. I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.